This is The Guardian.
Hallo, wir sind Julia Becker und Chris Sommer vom Podcast Drinnies. Hunde sind ja eher keine Drinnies, die wollen mehrfach täglich raus und mit anderen spielen, muss jeder selber wissen. Wer so viel unterwegs ist, sollte allerdings auch gut versichert sein. Die Tierkrankenversicherung von Petolo bietet euren Hunden und Katzen Vollschutz, das heißt OP und Krankenschutz.
Mit dem Gutscheincode Drinnies sichert ihr euch einen kostenfreien Probemonat, mit dem ihr einen Monat lang alle Petolo Services nutzen, sowie eine Videosprechstunde bei Dr. Fressnapf unverbindlich und kostenfrei testen könnt. Alle Infos dazu findet ihr auf petolo.de/drinnies.
Do you wonder about what's next in tech? Join us on Conversations with Leaders, a podcast from Amazon Web Services, and hear predictions from top minds in the industry like Vijay Chatur, co-founder and CEO of Blueshift.
Where this is going to go next is really about combining that Gen AI with what we call as customer AI. When you bring those two elements together, we feel that'll unlock the next level of the holy grail of personalization in some ways.
Subscribe and join the conversation today, available on all major podcast platforms.
Before we start, we're talking about assisted dying today, so there are references to distressing physical suffering, suicide, and death. One of the most significant pieces of legislation in recent history will be voted on in Westminster on Friday, answering a huge question. Should we allow terminally ill adults the right to an assisted death?
Who is anybody to deny them the choice of a death which will be done with compassion and understanding rather than huge amounts of trauma and suffering?
People who want a change in the law say it's time the UK finally began to address this issue. But those who are against warn that it's the start of a steep and slippery slope.
I have encountered such discrimination. We have such fear of the systems. I think the fear of giving them more power over our death really frightens us.
This isn't the kind of profound, far-reaching conversation many MPs are used to having, but here it is. So what happens next? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. The new Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill, referred to as the Assisted Dying Bill, has been introduced to the House of Commons by the Labour MP Kim Leadbeater. She was a guest on this podcast only a few weeks ago, and if you haven't, the episode featuring her and The Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee is really worth listening to. We're now at the crucial second reading of the bill, when, on Friday, MPs will get the chance to debate and vote on whether to pass it to the committee stage, a big step towards passing the bill into law. In this episode, we wanted to hear from two people with views of this bill and the huge issues surrounding it that are clear and direct and partly rooted in personal experience. Liz Carr is an actor and activist and recently made a brilliant documentary with the BBC looking at the subject of assisted dying, or as some people know it, assisted suicide, called Better Off Dead. Liz, first of all, you say that, and this is a quote, society can't permit euthanasia without endangering disabled people. Can you explain that a bit and why you believe that so strongly?
Yeah, and also just to say it's better off dead, question mark,
right.
Which I think it just aids with the, it's a challenge and a confrontation, you know. I believe that a lot of the call for assisted suicide and euthanasia around the world, the increased, of course, is from fear and lack of control. And yes, arguably arguments about autonomy and pain as well, as lots of different reasons. But these are usually the people who are involved in these campaigns are very often disabled people. Even when we hear it's about terminally ill people, A, there's a crossover, and many terminally ill people are actually disabled as well. But also, they extend, and the majority of laws in the world look at suffering as opposed to a very strict law. And I'm sure we'll get onto that, because I'm sure you're going to tell me. But this law won't do that.
Kim Leadbeater and the supporters of this bill would say, we're not talking about extending the provisions of it. This is very specifically about terminally ill people who are judged to have 6 months or less to live with the say-so of two doctors and a judge, and therefore, and I don't want to use cliches here, but one is inevitable, the slippery slope then, which would lead us to making decisions which disabled people quite rightly find very, very difficult to consider, that would be avoided.
Well, I would say that I don't believe her. I would say that to her face, you know, of course I would, in that I know I've been involved in this campaign way longer than she has. And I know that the aim is to get a bill over the line. That's what you do. And I've talked to legislators all over the world. And what I mean by that is the way to legislate for assisted suicide is to bring it in the town and the old people only, and to bring it in initially with really strict safeguards. So it's almost impossible to say no to it. Now, what happens then, we saw it in Luxembourg, we've seen it in the States, is that overuse of safeguards will be seen as inhibiting people's autonomy. So the courts will challenge that, and they will be able to do that through the European Convention of Human Rights, which comes in next. And what we know is that already we've got Dignity in Dying, you've got My Death, My Decision, you've got the Humanists. They're the three big players in the groups, the campaigns who want to change the law. My Death, My Decision, Humanists want an approach that's like Canada. And in Canada, it's for disabled people, and it will be for people with mental health conditions.
Talking of which, in Better Off Dead, you went to Vancouver and you saw what was happening in a part of the world where, as you see it, legislation had long since gone down that slippery slope. Tell me what you saw and how it made you feel.
Upsetting, really, you know, because I think it is our Commonwealth's cousin. And I was seeing, in part, the normalisation. So I'm now seeing a country where euthanasia is legal for people like me. And I meet a doctor who absolutely says to me if I was suffering. And this is a doctor who's passionate about human beings having autonomy over their own lives, who says, absolutely, you could be in the same condition as me or the same condition as her. But if they believe that they've got to a place where suffering was happening, then she would assist them through the law to end their life. And what happens there is what we were seeing is that people, really disabled people, using the law for now socioeconomic reasons, okay? So it's not about pain, physical pain. It's not about symptoms. It's because they cannot afford the support that they need. They're not getting their pain relief. That is everything we feared for a long time. And now we were seeing it happening, and we are seeing it more normalized. People going, well, yes, it does happen, because unless you're going to change all the systems and solve homelessness and sort out palliative care and healthcare, what else can we do? That was devastating for me.
Yeah, that's very sobering, isn't it? Because you and I both know in this country the huge intersection of disability with poverty, for example, right? We know the parlous state of social care services in most places, right? And so your argument is all of those things then would inevitably enter in to the decisions that people did or didn't make about this. It's impossible to separate the two.
And John, like, I met a guy called Amir Farsood. That for me was the story of the documentary, just in terms of how it touched me the most, because he had applied for MAID, as it's called, that medical assistance in dying, because of homelessness as a disabled person. So he qualified because he had a physical condition, but he qualified for a socioeconomic reason, homelessness. He'd lived homeless before, couldn't do it again. But somebody had helped him out financially. There was a crowdfunder. It became public. And he got the money to help him find an accessible home. So I'm talking to this kind of like, almost like this dead man walking, if he could walk. That was very sobering for me to go, we can solve some of the problems that people are experiencing that they're now using euthanasia and assisted suicide for. And absolutely, my fear is that once we cross that, Lord Faulkner in the documentary says a line in the sand, ridiculous thing to say because sand shifts. You know, where would this stop? Basically, the genie's never going back in the bottle. I know that's a cliche, but it's true.
Wes Streeting has come out against this bill, the health secretary. Is that in your thoughts as well? Because it's kind of hard to discern where exactly the argument falls here, but there is a lot of concern around among opponents of the bill about whether the NHS could cope with having to deliver assisted dying and assisted suicide as you'd see it, and therefore it might sort of jeopardise other bits of the NHS.
I think, yeah, I mean, once the Minister for Health and Social Services says this isn't a good idea, the system's broken and we can't afford it. And if we take from that, you know, because all the training that will have to happen, the pamphlets, whatever it is, you know, there's going to be a cost. So where does that money come from? But also, you know, what I think possibly is more relevant here is because I've lived in and out of the medical system for most of my life, I don't trust it. Okay. And this is not about individual brilliant people. This is not a takedown of the NHS. People work hard. However, they also have their prejudices, their misconceptions. And I actually find being in a health setting sometimes, quite often, in fact, the most disabling world I can be in. I'm frightened that doctors will be the safeguards. Two doctors need to assess you, I tell you. That thought terrifies me because I have encountered such discrimination and a lot of people in my community who do oppose. We have such fear of the systems and we need them to keep alive that I think the fear of giving them more power and that over our death really frightens us.
Just to push back for a minute, would you not want or be interested in the idea of assisted diet, assisted suicide, in some eventuality that hasn't happened yet, just as I would? So I don't know. I might get cancer, right? And that might put me in a sufficiently awful and unbearable place that this becomes an option which would kind of make my life better and would benefit me in various ways. I mean, forgive me, that might happen to you just as it might happen to anyone else. Are you really not interested in this as an option in any event?
Everybody in this campaign, Everybody wants everybody else to have a good death. I do believe that. We're all good people who want a good death. The only difference is how to do it. And I believe enough in the end of life care that could be, that we've shown the potential. We are very good at it in the UK, but we are not very good at it at the moment because it is cash strapped and it needs support. It gets a third of funding from the government. That's it. The rest is, you know, sitting in vats of beans and going to Costa Rica on a sponsored whatever. I mean, it struggles. Hospices are struggling at the moment. This debate brings up the worst of end of life, annoyingly, because it's so polarized. And actually, we all want, as I say, we all want good death. If you're a disabled person, you have a lot of my peers, a lot of my friends die young. And I've had that as well as relatives. So I do understand that too. I don't disagree that people have had horrific experiences and that is informing their worldview on this subject. Of course it does.
But aren't they entitled to a choice, therefore? You don't want it for you, and I understand completely you don't want it for disabled people. But if someone says, well, I watched my mother die in agony and a certain amount of indignity, we all know what that is, right? Maybe drugged out of their mind to ease the pain so that they couldn't really connect with anybody. And the whole thing amounted to an awful nightmare. And they would say that on a completely different set of grounds, you're denying them that option or other people in that situation that option. What's the answer?
You know, it would be the only aspect of healthcare, which is where this would sit, the administration and the actual processing of it, in the healthcare where you've got a choice. You don't get to go to your doctor and go, I want this. I'd like 8 x-rays and I'd like that checking. So firstly, let's just remember we have this sort of nirvana of I want whatever I want at the end of my life. Now, people are at the end of their life. Let's hope we can give them what they want. But choices, individual autonomy has to be balanced with the whole society that we live in. It's why we have laws. We know we're allowed freedoms. I tell you, as a disabled person that fights, absolutely fights with other disabled people for rights and choices and control, I get that. But I don't believe that it's a risk that we should take. Balance that individual choice, which we all hold dear, puts other people at risk, I believe. And that's where we have to look at the safety. How safe is safe enough? Are these safeguards going to work? And if there's a risk, that we could lose a life that shouldn't have been lost. Isn't that one life too many, I'd argue?
If the bill does get voted through this Friday, how will you feel?
Oh, God. I mean, you know, the press want to be in my face when we get the result. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, I really don't want that. I have been telling groups that I work with that even if it goes through on Friday, that doesn't mean the bill is, that doesn't mean it's a yes. It's not ideal. It's not the way to deal with a subject where a mistake equals murder, state murder, if we're being really dramatic. But it's also about a loss of life. And I think we forget that in all of this. This is not some, you know, nebulous concept. It is about real people who want to die pain-free. I understand that. But it's also about people who we want to protect because they probably don't have a voice like I do.
Thank you very much for joining us, Liz.
Thanks, John. It was really thought-provoking for me too.
Okay, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll hear from our political correspondent, Kieran Stacey, on what happens next for the bill and from the broadcaster, Mark Mardell, on why he thinks it doesn't go far enough.
Hallo, wir sind Julia Becker und Chris Sommer vom Podcast Drinnies. Hunde sind ja eher keine Drinnies, die wollen mehrfach täglich raus und mit anderen spielen. Muss jeder selber wissen. Wer so viel unterwegs ist, sollte allerdings auch gut versichert sein. Die Tierkrankenversicherung von Petolo bietet euren Hunden und Katzen Vollschutz, das heißt OP und Krankenschutz.
Mit dem Gutscheincode Drinnies sichert ihr euch einen kostenfreien Probemonat, mit dem ihr einen Monat lang alle Petolo Services nutzen, sowie eine Videosprechstunde bei Dr. Fressnapf unverbindlich und kostenfrei testen könnt. Alle Infos dazu findet ihr auf petolo.de/drinnies.
Jetzt ist Herbst und bald stehen schon wieder die Feiertage vor der Tür. Das kann auch für Hunde ganz schön stressig sein. Viele Vierbeiner reagieren unter anderem mit einer gestörten Verdauung und das ist wiederum Stress für ihre Besitzer. Aber es gibt schnelle und einfache Hilfe, das Probiotikum Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Streu einfach einen Beutel über das tägliche Futter. Die außergewöhnliche Zusammensetzung mit lebenden guten Darmbakterien stellt das Gleichgewicht im Darm wieder her. Natürlich kannst du ProPlan Fortiflora auch präventiv oder bei alltäglichen Verdauungsbeschwerden einsetzen. Es unterstützt auch bei Ernährungsumstellungen oder Antibiotikaeinnahme. Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Jetzt auf shop.purina.de.
Welcome back. I'm now joined from Westminster by The Guardian's political correspondent, Kieran Stacey.
Hey, John.
We're speaking to you on Wednesday afternoon. Can you just give me a sense of your thoughts, what it feels like, I suppose, watching the preamble, you know, the build-up to this very, very big watershed occasion? And it's not just a big parliamentary occasion. This is a big moment, potentially, in the sort of recent history of this country, isn't it? So tell me, what's going on there? What's your sense of it?
I was trying to remember the other day, John, whether I'd ever covered anything like this. I think I must have covered or at least watched the previous vote on assisted dying last time it came before the Commons. But you know what? I don't remember it. And I think that's partly because we knew it wasn't going to pass. The sense of, wow, something big might be about to change here, what just wasn't there. Then you had things like votes and debates on equal marriage. But again, like the result was a foregone conclusion. We knew which way it was going to go. The government was backing one particular outcome and was going to win. I don't think I've ever covered a political debate that has come to a vote, which would have a massive, massive change in the kind of social fabric, but also the politics of our country, where the result really genuinely wasn't known before we went into it.
That's the main variable, obviously, is which way the vote goes. But swirling around that are other things. Tell us about this amendment that's come up calling for the debate to be postponed. What do you think is going to happen with that? And do you think there'll be any other sort of last minute intervention?
I mean, there might be. It's fairly clearly a wrecking amendment. I think that it's couched as in words that suggest that, hey, look, we just need a bit more time here. But I think essentially, if you vote for this, you kill the bill's chances.
And remind us who's behind that amendment?
Yeah, so there's three people from three different parties behind that amendment. You've got the Tory Ben Spencer, Lib Dem Manira Wilson, and Labour's Anna Dixon have all sponsored that. You know, I don't particularly expect that to pass. I think people do want a chance to actually debate and vote on this occasion. But, you know, obviously, if that does pass, that gives you a sense that, well, the bill wasn't going to pass in the first place either.
Interesting things happen in and around a free vote, don't they? I mean, you've just talked about three MPs from different parties backing this amendment. Only a matter of days ago, Diane Abbott, the veteran left-wing Labour MP, went into temporary partnership with Edward Lee from the Conservative Party, who almost has the opposite politics in every conceivable sense, to say that there was too much of a rush and this wasn't the right way to do it.
Yeah.
So there are interesting things happening in Parliament in that way, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a great moment. You had Diane Abbott and Edward Lee writing a joint piece as mother and father of the house for The Guardian. I'm told that's the first time Edward Lee and his family have all read The Guardian. So we've converted some readers, if nothing else. Yeah, you've got these very, I mean, not only unusual alliances, but I think friendships that have been damaged. I can't remember if we talked about this before, John, but Wes Streeting was, before this debate, quite good friends with Kim Leadbeater. You know, he knew her sister Jo Cox. He's known the family for a while. I'm told that relations have really soured over the last few weeks between those two people, and we'll need some repairing after this. From what I'm told as well, just relations within the health department are pretty strained. You have Wes Streeting, who's come out as the most vocal opponent. Stephen Kinnock, who would probably be in charge of helping to implement this, at least within the Department of Health, is strongly in favour. And plenty of officials actually back Stephen Kinnock on that. So, you know, there's... Yeah, it's forged some unlikely alliances, and I think it's done some damage to really strong political friendships.
I'm going to ask you about that in the context of the government and the Labour Party right at the end. Just tell us, first of all, how you think Friday will play out. What's the sort of choreography?
Well, from what I'm told, the debate's going to start at about 9:30 in the morning. There's, I think, something like 170 MPs have applied to speak in it, and obviously I'm sure more will be bubbling up and down in the chamber. That means the Speaker's going to have to keep interventions very short. From, you know, my experience covering long, quite technical debates like this, what ends up happening is you get the first hour is where you get all the dramatic interventions, the really heavy hitters. I think it'll be really interesting to note the tone of the debate, particularly on the Labour benches, because it's already fairly ratty between the two sides. How heated do things get in the chamber? And are there one or two interventions that just, you know, really change the tone of the debate?
The sort of mood, the emotional approach that particular MPs take to this occasion and this debate must be very different in a lot of cases. Because there'll be some MPs who'll be thinking, I've waited years for this and I feel very strongly about it. And there'll be other MPs thinking, oh God, do we really have to get involved with this? This is impossibly complicated.
Yeah.
It's compromising my relationships with my colleagues and all of that. Does it feel like that, as if there are quite starkly different sort of emotions swirling around?
So there's quite a few MPs who've kind of turned up and in their first few months in office, having to think about something they've not really thought about for a while. There is some resentment I've picked up at people having, you know, had to make this decision. I've certainly picked up a lot of angst and a feeling of, well, because we don't know what the leadership wants to do, and because we don't really know whether the government's back is behind this, we don't know what to do either.
The more I read about this, the more it seems to me that to all intents and purposes, this is really government legislation, certainly sort of prime ministerial legislation. I know that's not a formal category, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And that the leadership of the Labour Party has been working very closely with Kim Leadbeater to take this bill through.
Yeah.
And there have been quite interesting, striking noises from people around the government. I read the other day that they'd said to people, look, this needs to get through, because if it doesn't, this issue will carry on rattling around and it'll intrude on the government's legislative programme and slow things up in various ways. Now, that sounds like BS to me, but that shows you it's not quite that the whips have completely gone away and that all of these party considerations have broken down. The government is a big player in all this, isn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't, and it's something actually we've been trying to get to the bottom of for a little while, and my colleague Jess Elger has been writing really good pieces about this, and I think is currently working on something on exactly these lines, where she's going to get under the skin of how much Number 10 has actually been responsible for this whole thing in the first place. Now, what I'm told is that Kim Leadbeater, once she'd come so high up in the ballot for private members' bills, then spent a while casting around, meeting various groups, deciding which bill she was going to bring forward. And then, you know, this was something she obviously cared deeply about, did run it past number 10 and said, look, if you disagree with this, then I'll drop it. Was told, you know, they didn't disagree, so decided to take it forward. So I think it's a nod and a wink rather than it was necessarily pushed by number 10. Clearly, Keir Starmer is in favour and, you know, has spoken and done things in favour as DPP in the past. But I think the officials in number 10 are much more split. So it's interesting that you say, John, that some people think that, well, you know, if this doesn't go through, it'll be a real problem. I know people in number 10 who think if this does go through, this is going to be a serious problem.
Right.
Because
right.
then you're going to have two departments, justice and health, which are in charge of managing a policy that neither of which is led by somebody who actually believes in it. And they once it if it does pass, it then becomes basically a government bill. You know, they then have to do things like impact assessments, and officials have to draw up how it's going to work. They actually then have to get involved and seriously do some work towards making it happen.
But there's another question there, you see. Everything in the build-up to this bill, let alone the bill being passed, has created these headaches and tensions and splits and all that, and is eating up a lot of attention. Seems like a kind of strange thing to green light on the government's part. Do you think there's anybody in number 10 or anywhere else in government thinking, God, this was a big thing to bite off?
Oh, yeah, there absolutely definitely are. And I'll tell you, one of them is Morgan McSweeney, Keir Starmer's chief of staff.
That's kind of who I'm driving at with this question.
Yeah, who looks askance at this and thinks, what on earth are we doing? This isn't one of our five missions, let alone our two priorities or our six first steps. You know, this isn't anywhere on the grid. Why are we expending so much political capital and time and internal party management on this? You know, there are others who say, well, look, we've got a massive majority. If we aren't able to do things that we genuinely believe in, then what's the point? But no, yeah. I mean, definitely there are plenty of people who think
that's part of the story, right? So, and now we'll move to the possible end of the story. Answer this as quickly as you can. Will it pass?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's
it. I'm not confident on that, but nonetheless, I think it will.
Thank you for joining us as ever, Kieran.
Thanks, John.
There are many arguments and reasons for why people believe it's finally time that the UK pass some form of assisted dying into law. Mark Mardell is a broadcaster who was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2022. He now presents the podcast Movers and Shakers and has been writing a blog for Prospect magazine about why, in his view, the bill being proposed should be passed, but actually doesn't go far enough. Mark, from your perspective and others as well, I dare say, can you just explain why you think it is time that the UK passed what the bill calls assisted dying into law?
Well, until recently, I never thought that deeply about it, although I did tell my eldest son some time ago that if it ever came to it, I should be put on a beach in Thailand with a big fat spliff and a cocktail of drugs that would kill me quite painlessly. Now, that was before I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and I didn't realise how stupid, bad parenting and irresponsible that was. But I mean, on reflection, I think if it does come to it, I should be allowed the choice to die. I want to stress that I don't want to die. I would never contemplate under normal circumstances suicide. I love life. I think that this bill does offer a lot of safeguards, in my view, too many.
But nonetheless, as a first step towards the kind of criteria you would like for assisted dying, clearly, I would imagine, you think that although it's somewhat frustrating, this bill is a step in the right direction. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, step in the right direction. If I was an MP, I'd have no hesitation in voting for it.
Given that it's your expectation that someone with Parkinson's, and in this case you, would be exempted from the provisions in this bill, just tell me what it feels like looking ahead, knowing that you won't have that option, given that you would like it.
Well, frustrating and annoying, really.
But is it something you're scared of as a consequence?
Yes. I mean, I think a lot of us living with Parkinson's bury our heads in the sand quite deliberately because it makes you want to seize the day, enjoy every moment you can. And, you know, as I say, I'm very, very far from the idea of wanting to kill myself right now. So, yes, it's something I don't try to think about, but, I mean, it is just a fact that it is possible, not inevitable by any means, because lots of other things can kill you in the interval, including falling from Parkinson's, choking from Parkinson's, or having a heart attack from something else completely or whatever, you know. But, I mean, it is possible that you will face an unpleasant, agonizing death where you're, I mean, have all sorts of multiple conditions, including possibly a form of dementia, blindness, not being able to communicate or speak at all, double incontinence. And now I don't know how I'd feel under those circumstances, but I mean, I would like the opportunity to die of time of my own choosing, if that was the case. And why would I vote for the bill even though it doesn't offer it? Well, because I think don't see why others should be deprived that choice.
But in supporting it inherently, you acknowledge that perhaps once this principle is introduced into the legal system and the culture, then the way then opens up perhaps for the criteria to be widened. And that is what some people, other people in this debate, would call a slippery slope. The point is you'd like to go quite a way down that slippery slope. So conditions like yours were definitely covered by the legislation, which brings another question into the conversation. Obviously, you would like it to cover Parkinson's. I dare say you'd like the same to apply to things like motor neurone disease. Are there lines in the sand for you, nonetheless, where you would say that although Kim Leadbeater's bill has shortcomings, you think there are criteria that shouldn't come into play? I mean, how do you feel personally about things like mental health as a consideration?
Well, I think that shouldn't be allowed.
Right.
You know, I think you get on to a question. If it is introduced, where do you end up in terms of attitudes towards suicide? And I think that's what a lot of disabled people who campaign on this, what a lot of religious people do fear. It'll just be free-for-all.
I suppose in the fullness of time, that's what they would fear, yes. Disabled people in particular.
Yeah, I mean, when we recorded our podcast on this, and before I started writing for Prospect about it, we spoke to Lord Charlie Faulkner, and one of the objections from one of my colleagues, Paul Mayhew Archer, he said, well, anybody should be allowed to go into a chemist and buy a pill and kill themselves. And we all said, well, hang on, you know, that has all sorts of implications, and I don't think that is right. So, no, I wouldn't go that far. I just want to say about the bill, where I feel it falls down, and it has these two big flaws to me, that although it's all about suffering, isn't it? It's all about preventing suffering at the end of life. But it has nothing about suffering in the bill. It's just this terminal diagnosis of 6 months.
Right, right.
So that's one of the big flaws.
Yes, but as you say, that, as Kim Leadbeater and her supporters would see it, is a way then of very strongly saying to people that this has limits, right?
Yeah.
And in point of fact, even terminal illness is quite a fuzzy definition, right? And 6 months left of life is something it's almost impossible, as I understand it, to come to a sort of hard and fast verdict on. So there are kind of uncertainties and shades of grey here, but I suppose that's why suffering doesn't come into it. But nonetheless...
Well, no, it's not why it doesn't come into it. It is deliberate, because they want to close off that option. And, I mean, yes, you're right about the 6 months. I mean, one of the first things when I was talking about doing this job for Prospect with one of my friends who's a neurologist, he said it's impossible to predict 6 months because you can't do it. And, you know, you look on the websites about this, and loads of people say, you know, I was given 6 months to live. And my sister-in-law was given 6 months to live, and she lived three years. So that's another uncertainty around it.
Yeah, so that's interesting, isn't it? So the kind of bill you would like, as you see it, although it would widen the criteria, it would be clearer in its definitions of what qualified someone to have that option. That's part of your criticism, actually.
Yeah.
That what some people see as a widening of the criteria would actually make the legislation clearer.
Yeah, and I think that's where, as in Canada, it has been expanded. That's why it's been expanded, because it doesn't work. And in Spain, where they have got the criteria of unbearable suffering, or some such phrase, it hasn't been abused as far as we can see. I don't think it's been abused in many places, because all the fears about what happened to the vulnerable, I don't know where that actually has happened. I mean, can you point to anywhere where people have been killed off unnecessarily? Or?
There are serious noises in Canada. I think actually changing the legislation has been delayed until 2027. But nonetheless, it's being discussed that perhaps the legislation should be widened to include people with mental health problems, who ought to be eligible for what they call medical assistance in dying. So in that sense, I think probably people on your side of the argument, it may be best advice to be honest and say that, you know, if this principle is introduced into legislation and the culture, of course it comes with those dangers.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I absolutely agree with that. And, I mean, I've been rather annoyed by the religious influence on this debate. So I decided to look at the one group of people who don't, well, not obviously, some of them are religious and some aren't. But I was talking to disabled campaigners, and that does worry me. Time during COVID when people were sort of put down as do not resuscitate and stuff like that. The feeling that I got from them, of vulnerability, the irritation, first of all,
yeah,
that they've been campaigning all their lives for better provision and being told there isn't enough money. Sorry about that. And then this bill comes along and it says it's a matter of principle, not pounds, shillings and pence. You'll have all the money you want, I guess, to do it. So that irritates them, I can understand. But also...
More than that, it causes them a great deal of anxiety.
Yeah.
In the sense that when I have a son who's autistic and learning disabled, and there is a sense, really, that the odds medically and in terms of healthcare and the NHS and all that are kind of stacked against you institutionally, right? There's still not enough collective understanding in the NHS of what it is to be learning disabled and or autistic. And therefore, the introduction of this principle in law causes me, although I can see completely why someone like yourself would want this option. I get that. This is really, really complicated. Nonetheless, from my own perspective and that of my son, it worries me. And it worries our first guest, Liz Carr, for sort of different but comparable reasons. But that's not enough to completely dissuade you of the rightness of doing it.
Tell me what exactly it is you're worried about with your son.
Well, very, very recently, as you've said, in the pandemic, there were providers of social care who, as I understand it, embraced giving do not resuscitate orders to learning disabled people. Now, if you then move to a legal system in which suffering is taken as something which then would qualify someone for the option of assisted dying, I begin then to worry about it being presented to the carers or the learning disabled person themselves as one of their options. And if you're in a country in which social care is falling down, then it might look like the better option.
Well, I agree with those worries, and I think they should be hemmed in by the law. I think that should be absolutely clear, and I think that's one of the reasons we need a big debate about this, to make sure that that doesn't happen.
And does that therefore mean that watching this happen, you have felt a frustration about the process? Because I don't know, I'm not sure really what I think ultimately about this, I'll be honest. It's really difficult to decide, right? But I don't...
Nor do I.
But I don't think this sort of hurried debate on however many hours we're going to get on Friday, and it, you know, this idea that, oh, we're now finally at the cusp of this coming into law, so we're going to have this very, very sort of accelerated discussion about it, when it involves all of these things that you and I have been discussing for the last 9 or 10 minutes, I would like a citizens' assembly or a royal commission and something much more deliberative and accountable that would do justice to the kind of questions that we're discussing.
I think if the bill is passed on Friday, then you'll get that.
That's interesting.
But I think you'll get the process going through the House of Lords. I mean, you know, any bill we've seen, there's very rarely, apart from Dangerous Dogs, which is always cited, is thrust through without much debate. I mean, it's endless debate, isn't there?
Right. Let's move to your sort of feelings looking ahead to Friday. If it passes, does that mean that your understanding of your own condition and the rest of your life will be coloured by a certain optimism that wasn't there before?
Well, I wouldn't say it was an optimism about it.
That's the wrong word, but what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, it will be... I think if it passes, I have to decide whether I join those who are campaigning for a widening and changing of the law, or whether I just say, tough on me, but there we are, that's where we are. Because I do see the doubts, and even the religious arguments, which I despise on many grounds, I do see the I don't know, are you religious? Is that why you're laughing?
I'm not religious at all. I'm an agnostic. But I think in the midst of this debate, I think religious people have got a bad rap, because it just so happens that their sort of moral philosophy is predicated on the idea of God, right? And other people's moral philosophy, in this case yours and mine, isn't. But I don't think the fact that God is in there somewhere, as far as they're concerned, makes their views illegitimate or worthy of despising. I don't. It's just another way of looking at the world. And I'll fess up, actually, my moral view of the world, I suppose, is essentially Judeo-Christian. I'm sure yours probably is as well.
Yeah, it is. Of course it is. But in many ways.
So what's the difference? They still go to church and you don't?
No. It's because, there's a bill today, isn't there? There's a lot of debate about NHS dentistry. I don't care what the tooth fairy says about it.
But I think the God of Christian and Jewish and Muslim and the gods of Hindu people are a bit more profound than the tooth fairy, to be fair.
Well, they might be, but I mean, the Catholic argument, in particular Catholic argument, appears to be that it's a sin because God gives life and it's up to him to take it away, not you. And because suffering is somehow good.
One last question. I've asked you how you'll feel if the bill goes through. If it falls, how will you feel?
Disappointed. And I think the debate will be I don't know. Will the debate be over or not? I mean, I don't,
it's a good, really good question. Really good question.
And I haven't got my head around even what I'm writing yet, but it's in the ballpark of, as we live longer, as medical science improves, you know, do you have to have a debate about how we die if we're going to live that long? Do we want to, at some stage, say, granny, granddad, me, can be surrounded by their family, take a couple of pills when it's got too much, or do we just wait until, like the cicada of Greek mythology, just sort of witter on endlessly?
I do. I know exactly what you mean. And I think, just to underline what you've just said, even though I personally have doubts and misgivings about this, just the same as you have, they might be slightly different ones, but we sort of feel the same way in that regard. I don't think this is going away for the reasons you've just mentioned about how long people live and so on, but also because this isn't the 19th century and people are much less deferential than they used to be. And I think they have an expectation of autonomy and asserting themselves.
Take back control.
And so on. And I don't think you can put those things back in the box. So in that sense, whatever happens on Friday, I think this will go on.
Good. And I hope my writing for Prospect will go on for a year. We're intending to run the blog for a year. So follow me there.
And I will carry on reading it in the build-up to this interview. I have really, really enjoyed it and been very stimulated and challenged by things you've written in Prospect. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please, as I always say, make sure you subscribe to Politics Week UK wherever you get your podcasts. And you might want to think about leaving us a review, a nice one, of course. For more on this really important topic on our sister podcast Today in Focus, Helen Pidd will be speaking to MPs on both sides of the issue about how they'll vote. That's out on Thursday. This episode of Politics Week in the UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
Hallo, wir sind Julia Becker und Chris Sommer vom Podcast Drinnies. Hunde sind ja eher keine Drinnies, die wollen mehrfach täglich raus und mit anderen spielen, muss jeder selber wissen. Wer so viel unterwegs ist, sollte allerdings auch gut versichert sein. Die Tierkrankenversicherung von Pertolo bietet euren Hunden und Katzen Vollschutz, das heißt OP und Krankenschutz.
Mit dem Gutscheincode Drinnies sichert ihr euch einen kostenfreien Probemonat, mit dem ihr einen Monat lang alle Pertolo Services nutzen, sowie eine Videosprechstunde bei Dr. Fressnapf unverbindlich und kostenfrei testen könnt. Alle Infos dazu findet ihr auf pertolo.de/drinnies.
How can governments play a pivotal role as the world shifts? From decarbonizing the economy to sustainable care systems, bold government strategies are needed now more than ever. Get informed by listening to Government Insights, the new podcast from EY Parthenon. This series explores how government executives can transform their strategies into actions that are future-proof and sustainable. Government Insights is out now. Download today wherever you get your podcasts.